the conceit of the exhibition in which this appeared was that it was mounted in 86. There were about 170 artists, and it was a fictive collector's home as the conceit of the exhibition, and it was supposed to be a history of Southern California art. So it foregrounds the patron collector as the sort of center of culture and center of holding history, and single, of course, then that foregrounds like static artworks. So there's a set of like foregroundings that sort of favors certain kinds of practice that would be more apropos to a commercial gallery. And then his intervention, his work is this portal to fundraise like the very opposite, and to actually then, you know, push out to the hundreds of other kinds of artists that Farr historically and would continue to support. So it's such an interesting intervention in the relation of this exhibition.
Just also that the work itself was technically for sale, right? Given like the context of the exhibition.
I honestly don't recall if the work was for sale. Have you seen a price list, or has Jean said anything to you about that?
There is a price list with it on there. I guess I was very curious what that would mean.
but then it was destroyed the first night. So, you know, which is not perfect. Yeah, I was thinking of it more in terms of Michael poking the exhibition in the eye, basically.
I think that's really true.
I mean, yeah, I have this memory of sitting with Michael, and we would sit at this place and have coffee. I think maybe it was, there was like a bookstore that had a lot of old books near the New Art, and that Michael got this mischievous kind of grin. He could be that way. And proposed this idea about how to help Farr. Like, I have an idea about how to help Farr. You know, what if I designed some stationery, and then we could send out some letters in the stationery I designed. And, you know, the envelope, on the backside of the envelope, it says, make check payable to Farr. You know, and that's kind of my memory of it. Again, it's pretty vague, but I do remember a grin, and I do remember him sort of proposing this idea. Me sort of saying, yeah, you know, that sounds amazing, and I have to run it by my board. And he may have proposed it to us as a group. I don't remember, though. This is probably more likely, given that I was hanging out with him fairly frequently in this period of time.
What did the rest of the board think of the project?
I'm 65 years old now. I don't remember it anymore.
Yeah, so as you're looking at the installation, you may have generated all these documents. It's likely.
You know, Michael's all over this thing. I mean, I don't know that he wrote it necessarily, but his influence is all over it. So, you know, like the paragraphs where it's, you know, artists' projects are selected on the basis of the specific problems the proposed work addresses, that the proposal acknowledges its presented questions of central concern to the board of directors and its selection procedures. Farr responds to work with these qualities without regard for genre, that criteria cannot be absolute, is at the core of an ongoing discussion amongst the board. I mean, you can hear that kind of, you know, influence. Even though we may have written it, two of us were ex-students of Michael's to some degree, so you can kind of hear it in some of this, for sure. He didn't write it, but his voice is there, and I'm pretty sure, I can't say for absolute sure, but I'm pretty sure before Michael would lay this down in a work of his, he would have read it. So, yeah. Anyway, not that he would have edited it necessarily, but he definitely would have read it. And I didn't really remember that the language was quite like that. It certainly echoes, you know, kind of my own position in my own work at certain points as well.
Yeah, that's fascinating that you hear his voice, like Farr's voice and his voice kind of intermingled there.
Yeah, and I don't remember going to the show. I don't know why. I just have no memory of ever seeing it installed. So I know that it happened. I know that I played a role in it. I can see my own writing and some of the writing in this document. So I know I helped write this. You know, I still write this way. So you know, but we would have all, I mean, we were very collective oriented, and we would have all passed judgment on and approved anything that happened like this, because we would have never ceded that authority to one person, because that was not the nature of what it was at that time. And probably Morgan would have read it through. For sure, Michael would have read it through. I'm not sure if anybody else would have actually read it through. Yeah, so this is happening about a year after, or a year and a half after, this set of people took over this organization. So we were all recruited out of grad school by two people, one of whose name I remember and the other one whose name I don't remember. One of them was Martine Tomchek. And because the organization had whittled down to nothingness at that point and had been relatively inactive. And that was the usual cycle for FAR, actually. It, because of the way that it was constructed, which is that it's an all-volunteer board of directors. And as you can see in this crazy letter, it says we're meeting bi-weekly. And I'm sort of thinking to myself, really? We did? That's a lot. It's mm-hmm. an awful lot.
That, I mean, that's a lot for, yeah, for working artists to run an organization that, to, you know, that's this active.
I know. I was shocked by that.
In addition to their other duties and responsibilities and their artistic practices, is a lot.
Yeah. And I was working, you know, when all of this, for me personally, when all of this was happening, I was still working for Margot Levin as her bookkeeper and her financial person. And I was curating a show with Brad Dunning that happened in the gallery. And I was having my first solo show. So it was, you know, a little busy. And Liz was in the show I was curating for Margot. And Annetta was having her own practice. And Nick was doing his thing. It may have even been, the Blue Daisies may have been even still happening, which was the band that Nick Green had with Jeff Poe. If you really want to go into LA history, the LA history that's within this board, it's kind of crazy. So everybody's kind of doing their thing and at the same time trying to reinvigorate this organization. And I think the way that this history and purpose functioned, and the reason that Michael suggested what he did in terms of a fundraising campaign, is we were trying to restart the organization in a way, rewriting its mission and the things that it might potentially accomplish, you know, in our own voice, as opposed to the voice of a prior board of directors. And I think this is cyclically how FAR functioned, is that people would serve on the board and then kind of burn themselves out and then recruit a new board, on and on and on.
Wow. So Cindy, like this board, it's five names, you know, Cindy Bernard, Nick Green, Annetta Capon, Liz Larner, Denise Marika. Were they all CalArts students? Like, were those all a cohort that you knew them all?
No. So Liz and I came from CalArts, and Liz and I were good friends at CalArts. Annetta and Nick, I think, came from Otis. And I'm not sure where Denise came from. That could be wrong about Annetta and Nick. I'm pretty sure, though, because I think that Jeff Poe might have gone to Otis or had some cross with Otis at some point, and that's where that band comes from. So I'm pretty sure Nick also went to Otis, and Annetta went to Otis. And then the other sort of, you know, what you have happening at that time, and again, this is just, you know, memory is imperfect, so this is just my memory, is that it's possible at this point in the 80s that Chris Williams and Steve Perina were teaching at Otis in this same rough period of time. So who both were very close to Michael when they were at CalArts, and obviously heavily influenced by him. So you have all this sort of cross-pollination going on. across the different schools. And I think that going to the different schools was intentional at that time, too, to make sure that you were getting perspectives that had been bred from different programs. It's possible Denise went to UCLA. I know that at some point Ambre is involved, and Ambre definitely went to UCLA. I think she was a UCLA recruit. That's my memory. So I think that's the genesis of that group of people. And some of this board of advisors was more active than others, as is inevitable in any organizational board of advisors. So, you know, like when I stayed very close to John, just as I had stayed very close to Michael, and John Baldessari, who was on the board of advisors. So the board of advisors that's on this letter is Michael Asher, John Baldessari, James Butler, Rosamund Felsen, Morgan Fisher, Frank Geary, who, God forbid, I never saw, Hal Glicksman, Joan Hugo, Morgan Thomas, and Paul Zanatopoulos. I mean, I did see Frank Geary, but only when he was starting to do a project for John, when I was started working for John. So at this time, I was working for Margot and about to transition within about 3 years to working for John Baldessari. Yeah, it's interesting when you look at the letter from the perspective of time, how many weird connections it's possible to recognize. And definitely, they are really there. I mean, and they go off in all sorts of other directions just because of the relationships that these people had. So at that time, I think, I mean, I could go even far. It's just a crazy web of interrelationships, because even though Annetta did not go to CalArts, I think she was married at that time. Her husband was friends with Mike Davis and Alan Sekula. And then Alan Sekula, of course, was also teaching at CalArts. You know, it's just sort of like one degree all over the place.
And when you were in this, when you joined FAR, I mean, outside of this project, was Asher active as a board of as an advisory board member? Do you have much memory of his interaction with the organization?
Well, I was having a lot of interactions with Michael, so I don't know that, you know, 40 years on, if it's possible for me to clearly distinguish my own hanging out with Michael from FAR hanging out with Michael. I certainly, in my memory, Michael and Morgan, who were friends, were very active. And then the programs that are a part of this, you know, are born out of the idea that FAR never had a space, so that the space of FAR was essentially the city. I mean, that was what happened with SASIS too. I mean, when I formed SASIS, it comes out of this kind of philosophy about, you know, how much money do you really want to put into brick and mortar, and how much, you know, does that not having that free you to be able to do all sorts of programming that is unusual or innovative or freed from that constraint, which again, you can, you know, Michael's own practice kind of echoes that.
Yeah. And Cindy, you came to know Michael from school, and then just sort of, and that began a kind of deep relationship and friendship, and is that right? From CalArts?
Yeah. So I think I took the post-studio class. I think I took it twice. And then Michael, I think, I don't know if he was ever formally a mentor, but I worked with him a lot. And then afterwards, we remained friends. He lived in, I want to say sort of off, somewhere off of Pico and something. And there was a little Mexican restaurant there that was his favorite Mexican restaurant. We would have dinner at the, or lunch at the Mexican restaurant. And yeah, coffee, or I think we went to an opening couple of times, whatever, you know, just the way people hang out for a couple of years after I graduated. I mean, I think the thing that often disrupted relationships with Michael is differences over the nature of one's practice and what one ends up doing. And I don't really remember why we stopped hanging out as we were hanging out for those few years. after school. But, you know, inevitably it happens less and less frequently. But he remained supportive afar, I believe, because, you know, just the very nature of the organization was something that he believed in, since, you know, he left so theoretically, he left so few traces of his own practice outside of archives.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's so interesting that Farr was, and this I think I saw on the Wikipedia, Farr was founded by Morgan Thomas, Connie Llewellyn, and Claire Copley, all of whom he also would have had really deep, long relationships with, who were working in, who, you know, who defined galleries, but then also kind of came to see the benefit of this other structure.
Yes, yes. And of course, he made that work with Claire Copley, so.
Yeah. Yeah, and he did a Claire Copley Morgan Thomas gallery swap too, as another show, where he had them each make work, you know, basically work in the other's space.
Yeah. And so, and then this organization, I think, gets kind of born out of all of those interactions, because what are the years of those works? Because Farr is in 1977, so what are the years when he does the show with Claire?
That show's 74, the one where he takes the gallery and office wall down. So just 3 years earlier.
And then at some point he does that thing with Leica, too, in that sort of same 70s period of time.
Can I ask, because, I mean, one intriguing part of this, in addition to all these documents, which I'm, you know, like you and Farr would have had to pull together, the slogan, influence your culture, donate to Farr, which we were imagined was maybe painted by Norm Latch, just knowing that he often did that kind of work.
We talked about that. Yeah, it's highly likely that Norm would have done that work, also because he did work for John as well. It's possible that if you talked to Norm, he'd have a memory of the slogan. But my guess is that the slogan would have come, it didn't come from me, so it would have either had to come from Michael or another board member. I don't remember this. I don't remember generating the slogan at all.
But doesn't it seem like it did come from Michael, just based on the notes in the archive, because he had so many other ideas for the slogan that were like kind of similar?
Is there like a brainstorming list from Michael about the slogan?
I see like one idea that's like influence the narrative around you, influence your audience, influence the general public, donate to Farr. That's funny. Welcome to Cirrus, donate to Farr.
Yeah, and it's possible that he brainstormed some of that with us, or that he had the letter in hand when he was brainstorming the slogan, because, you know, that isn't exactly here, but that idea of, you know, it goes back to that, you know, Dave Muller kind of, is it Dave Muller? Doesn't Dave say something like Michael Asher branded him a cultural producer or some such thing? You know, that kind of phrasing about how one defines a practice that is not the usual wall-based or floor-based practice, that kind of language is Michael language, or Michael thinking, maybe.
There's one that says, don't restrict your experience. That one's really good. Or wait, if you have not seen enough, donate to Farr.
Oh, and here's one. Shopping, donate to Farr.
Oh, that one's really good.
That's really good. That could be a t-shirt now. That's so interesting.
And then there's also a lot of sketches for the design of the actual display.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So it seems like it makes me think that he like really considered the design aspect, how it was going to be presented.
Well, it was designed as though he expected that that people would just pull the envelope out of the plexi thing and put a check in it and mail it. I don't recall that ever happened, by the way. So I'm sure, you know, somebody did, but, and also it was reliant on someone, of course, reading all of those texts and looking at our budget and concluding that they should give us money. I mean, we did get donations, but I can't speak to how many donations this actually generated, especially given that it was up for such a short period of time.
There is a letter, January 19th, 1987, from Annetta to Peter and Eileen Norton. And it says, on behalf of the Foundation for Art Resources, I am writing to express our warmest gratitude for your generous donation of $100. I guess it's during the run of the show, and he has it in his correspondences, so maybe that came somehow from the show or from Michael?
Yeah, that's really interesting.
Yeah, it looks like there's a couple of letters, thank you letters that were sent, and it's like all $100 donations.
Well, that's nice. I'm glad that people were donating. I would have processed the checks.
Yeah, the one other material component is the envelope, you know, and it's, and again, like, Stella's saying there's some sketches in the archive of him working out like the line breaks and the font, and in what we're finding more and more typical, he likes Futura as the font. It's very typical that he used that font for, you know, several projects, and there's a look to his graphic design work, and this definitely is a high example of that. But I guess that's a key moment where he designed that envelope and then printed them with that typeface and that kind of like style.
And it's clear that he didn't want to usurp the style of Farr at that time, which is probably, you know, this kind of old IBM or Epson computer with a typeface across the top that looks like it was done on a typewriter. Because there's a difference between the design of all of those pages, which I can even tell by looking at this, you know, were produced that way, and the design of the envelope, which is clearly, you know, laid out and printed differently. You know, it's laid out for print in a way that this isn't. This is laid out for a different kind of distribution.
Yeah, it is.
That's, I think, also an interesting difference. I also know, now that I'm looking at this, that on the wall, this is me getting really detailed. On the wall, you know, he has a very determined definition of the acronym. If you look in the corner of the letter, we don't use those periods.
Ah, that's an interesting point, yeah.
I mean, I was looking at this and thinking, it looks weird to me because I don't remember that we ever really formally would use those periods like that.
No, it looks like in the letters you write, you never use it.
Never do, right?
Yeah. What do you think that means?
So that must have been a Michael decision, because we didn't ever did that. That was Michael.
Yeah, I even think the period after Influence Your Culture is a little, you know, you don't always need a period on a phrase like that on the wall.
Well, I was just thinking the wall graphic kind of reminds, the design reminds me of Think Small campaign with the like period after Think Small. I guess that's like recalling advertising in this way. Of slogan and then a period.
It's all very deliberate, obviously.
Yes, it's very deliberate. That's a great word. It's so interesting. I never noticed that before, but yeah, there's no, we never put periods in the acronym.
Oh, and you know what's funny? On the return envelope, there's no periods. On the envelope he designed, it's all caps, no periods. And then on the wall, it's with periods.
I wonder if that was whoever designed the wall graphic made that judgment and Michael went with it. Well, and also, what was the font on all of Barbara's early work?
Barbara Bloom?
Kruger.
Oh, Barbara Kruger. Futura. Futura.
Yeah. So, you know, just saying. I don't know that the use of Futura comes out of nowhere.
I don't think so.
Oh my God. This is so great, Cindy. I mean, really, thank you.